DW, Living Planet, with Jordan Wilden.
We have a complex relationship with the other living beings around us, from farming animals, keeping pets, and even conservation work to restore creatures' habitats. We exercise godlike control over the environment around us, making decisions about what creatures deserve to live amongst us and which of them don't. This week on Living Planet, we're exploring all of this and more as we examine the relationship between humans and other life around us. Stick with us. Coral is an indicator of the state of the waters that surround it. Coral itself is actually built from tiny animals, polyps, that have a close relationship with everything around them. The algae that lives on them is their food source, and fish live and breed amongst the reefs. In Gibraltar, a tiny strip of British territory on the southern tip of Spain, experiments to establish Europe's first artificial reefs are underway, hopefully to encourage fish to breed. Nick Martin reports.
I need a little oasis where sea life can breed, live, swim round and have safety from bigger sea life that's going to eat it, and it's not all sand-dwelling.
Marine biologist Dr. Eric Shaw remembers his original plan for an artificial reef as far back as 1973. He had noticed a dramatic decline in the number of fish species in the waters around Gibraltar. Shaw's early experiments failed when a collection of tyres he sank into the sea was washed away by the strong winter currents. So he turned to boats, which he said would normally be scuttled much further out in the Mediterranean.
The barges worked out all right, so when they started getting lighters and different barges in the harbour area here that were beyond local requirements, we'd exchange them for pounds, and now you become the owner, and you talk people into taking it out there with you, put holes in the correct places, and sink them.
4 decades on, and more than 50 vessels now make up Gibraltar's artificial reef, which has become a model followed by many other countries.
The vessels stretch from, you know, from 30 metres long, 35 metres long, to small boats that are only 6 metres long. You know, any vessel is a good vessel. You mix the wooden vessels in and amongst the metal vessels. Why? Because you've got life that lives on wooden wrecks. And the wooden wrecks very, very, very slowly will be broken down until there's nothing. And what we should be doing is just keep on doing this.
Shaw says Europe's first artificial reef is now teeming with life. Coral, lobsters, crabs, octopus, eels, bream and bass have all moved in and revitalised the local marine environment.
That life is there because there's somewhere to go and hide, and you've got to have a habitat, because it's a dog-eat-dog world out there, whether we like it or whether we don't. It's from the zooplanktons right up to the great groupers. Everything's eating something. But when you've got an anomaly on the seabed there, if you leave that anomaly and let everything breed on it, and then when the pelagic fish that move out of the deep oceans and come into the shoreline habitat to breed, that's where the little fry can seek sanctuary until they're big enough to swim out into the open sea again.
Gibraltar is just a tiny representation of the global growth in artificial reefs. The US has thousands of them along its coastline, including 2 million used vehicle tyres off the coast of Fort Lauderdale in Florida. Around the world, scores of ex-Navy ships have been scuttled in the name of marine life protection. France has ordered the removal of some of its artificial reefs made from tyres due to concerns about heavy metals being released into the sea off its much-prized Riviera. Dr. Jean-Luc Salant from the UK's Marine Conservation Society thinks the benefits of artificial reefs are overstated.
If you put a couple of wrecks down, that's great locally, but it's not going to recover the problem with the world's over-exploitation of natural resources. You know, that's on a global scale. The Mediterranean is the most overfished sea in the world, and putting artificial wrecks in the area of Gibraltar is going to be fine for Gibraltar, because already Gibraltar is a marine reserve. But to suggest that this is going to solve the world's problems of overfishing, that's illusory.
Pollution also remains a major threat from the scuttling of so many vessels. If not removed, oil, fuel, coolants, lead paint, and even asbestos can leach into the ocean and could even enter the food chain.
It just has to be done sensitively. It has to be proper environmental impact assessment about how it's done, how clean the vessel is, how it's used, what you think the materials are on the vessel, both internally, the oil substances, for example, and the metals that are going to erode and corrode, and how marine life will colonise onto those.
Shaw insists that each of his vessels undergoes thorough preparation before being sunk.
MARS stands for Modular Artificial Reef Structure. When used in conjunction with coral farming,
proponents of artificial reefs insist they have the potential to play a bigger part in protecting our oceans from climate change. Faced with the catastrophic decline of its natural coral reefs due to overfishing and sea warming, last year the Maldives introduced the world's largest 3D printed reef.
On Summer Island in the Maldives, they don't actually have any natural reef on this specific site. They just have sand bottom.
Artificial barriers stop large fishing ships from getting too close to growing shoals of fish and large trawlers from dragging their nets on the seafloor. But critics say they tend to concentrate fish in one location.
The sheer size of these new wind turbines means just one rotation produces enough electricity to power a home for 24 hours.
And although they were never designed as artificial reefs, offshore wind farms are increasingly playing a secondary role in protecting the marine environment.
And bigger projects mean wind makes up a greater share of generation.
They too provide a similar sheltered habitat for crustaceans and fish to grow. Springing up off the coast of China, the US, Germany and Britain, these huge infrastructure projects often span several square kilometres and have noticeably reduced overfishing, Salant says.
The absence of trawling that comes from those wind farms is far more beneficial, frankly, than possibly even the wind energy that is generated from it. Because, frankly, the marine protected areas that we have away from the offshore wind farms, would you believe, we can't protect them. So the only marine protected areas in a way that we have in the offshore environment in the United Kingdom domestic is wind farms. How ironic is that?
Other new technologies like tidal energy projects could help strengthen the argument for artificial reefs, as they will also give marine life protected areas to flourish. Stricter rules on scuttling will also help, so that our seas are no longer convenient dumping grounds for industrial and military machinery. Nick Martin, DW, Gibraltar.
Can't get enough of coral? Want to know more about the environment, science and health? If you use a Google Home or Google Assistant, DW Discoveries is for you. Just say, OK Google, open DW Discoveries, and hear discoveries like this one about coral's relationship with algae.
Have you ever wondered how a coral reef gets its dazzling colour? Or what happens when a coral reef gets bleached? The answer to both of these questions has to do with algae. Every coral has a symbiotic relationship with microscopically small algae. They live in the tissue of the coral and are its food. Without them, the coral loses its color and takes on a sickly white appearance. Marine biologists say the coral is bleached. It does not mean the coral is dead yet. They can survive a bleaching event, but if nothing's done to get that algae back in a hurry, it's game over for the coral.
That was DW's Gabriel Borrod on DW Discoveries, now available on Google Home and Google Assistant. Now we move from the dark depths of the underwater world to deep inside caves in northern Mombasa in Kenya. Here, villagers in the Kikambala area have come together to help protect the owls that have made the area their home. As Diana Wanyonyi learned, this is a difficult task when many people see the owls and their hooting as a bad omen. Natalie Muller presents this report.
The African barn owl is a rare bird residing in the deep cave at Kikambala. It's not territorial, but has regular hunting habits and often returns to the preferred feeding station. The cave tour guide hushes everyone, requesting that they walk silently and talk quietly so as not to spook the birds. The cave is estimated to be 60 feet below sea level and is home to the owls and other birds. Abdallah Kahindi is one of the tour guides here.
According to African folklore, owls are associated with a bad omen. They say that when an owl hoots, death will occur. We've worked to remove the negative attitude that their hoots are a bad omen, and we looked for a place where we can conserve them. When we came to the cave, we realized there are many owls here, and that's when we started to take care of them. There are some tourists who come to camp here to see the owls, and we use the money made from the tourism to sustain ourselves financially.
Owls mainly feed on small rodents, snakes, bats, lizards and insects, but exploit other locally abundant food. And their leftovers are crucial to finding where they like to nest.
I'm holding rats' bones in my hands. Owls eat rats and small birds, and when they're done eating, they drop the bones down on below. It's a clear indicator that their nests are on the upper side or ceiling of the cave. Another indicator are their fecal droppings.
Before the abolition of slave trade during the colonial era, this cave, which is located 300 metres from the Indian Ocean, was used as a hideout by the male natives to escape Arabs who were looking for them. Now this cave is also sacred to the Mijikenda community. Hussein Ali is one of the Mijikenda elders who are always clad in a traditional red waist wrapper. He says the owls are intelligent and friendly.
We look after these birds, and their droppings are used while planting crops. They drink water from an underground spring in this cave. This cave was created by God. No human being built it. These owls are intelligent and understanding. When you come here, they look at you to see if you will give them bananas or not. They are like human beings. We don't allow anyone to chase or harm them. When they hoot and you have a sick person, you should rush him or her to hospital.
Usually, the owls can only be seen early in the morning and late at night. But for visitors during the day, the Mijikenda elders have found a way to coerce them out, the native music and whistling from Elder Nzuru Mulewa. When they hear it, the owls will slowly come out to enjoy the music.
There are blessings in this cave. People come here to kneel and pray. When I come here, I always whistle, and then the owls come out from their hiding places. When visitors come here and they request to see them, I whistle, and as usual, they come out.
Being on top of the food pyramid, owls act as an environmental indicator. Their numbers and breeding success acts as a pointer to the status of the environment. A decline in their number is an early warning for environmental degradation. However, with support from the local villagers, the owls and their habitat may be in good hands.
You're listening to DW's Living Planet. I'm Jordan Wildern. We've just heard about how owls have learned to live side by side with humans in the caves of Mombasa in Kenya. But that's not the only place birds have developed a close relationship with humans. 50 years ago, a particular breed of parakeets began to make Germany their home and started to live within the cities along the River Rhine. So, how did the parakeets come from African and Asian subcontinents to Europe? And do they affect the local bird population? These were the questions that puzzled Daphne Altayuk as she was walking along the Rhine.
The sun in Germany is not generous. Even though it's the end of March, it's still cold and windy. As I take a walk along the River Rhine, all of a sudden, a shadow passes over me. It's a bright green bird with a long tail. After a couple of flaps, it lands on a branch of a tree. The bird has feathers as green as pistachio, a tail as long as its whole body, a bright red beak, and a circle around its neck. That's a parrot! 20 seconds later, 10 more parrots follow, landing on the tree. They make a quite stark contrast to the dark branches of the tree that still doesn't have any leaves yet. I'm surprised to find exotic parrots living here in Germany. But when I ask other people along the riverside, I realize they are used to them.
Ach, das sind diese grünen.
Yeah. Ah, those are the green ones. Yeah, I already know them from my home in Neuss because they're always flying around there. And the annoying thing about them is that they actually don't sing very well. They're always crowing. Otherwise, it's quite nice when they fly around here.
Hier am Rhein habe ich sie noch nicht gesehen, aber ich weiß.
Here on the Rhine, I haven't seen them yet, but I know that last year around the university, they were quite often in the trees, and they always looked very nice there.
They do look nice, and I can't help but wonder. Parrots usually live in Africa and Asia. So how did they end up living here? In theory, parrots are able to talk and understand human languages. But I guess it wouldn't be easy to conduct an interview with them. So I go and ask my questions to an expert at the Zoological Research Museum König here in Bonn. At the museum, ornithologist Dr. Till Töpfe takes me to a room with a high ceiling, where stuffed birds are displayed in dark wooden cabinets. The museum and its collection date back to the early 1900s. Töpfer explains that there are 145,000 specimens of birds in drawers and in closets. They represent roughly half of all the bird species in the world. Such a crazy and a bit creepy place. Dr. Töpfe opens the drawer for the ringneck parakeets. 30 different stuffed green parakeets are on display, each labeled with a neat piece of paper.
So, we've got here a bunch of study specimens.
They come from different places such as Bonn, India and Senegal.
This is a proper African representative. The ringneck parakeets are to be found in Asia, so particularly on the Indian subcontinent and in Africa. So there are at least two populations that might have given rise to the population that we can find now here in the Rhineland.
So he tells me the parakeets now living in the Rhineland are probably offspring from a few parakeets that escaped the Cologne Zoo in 1969. Also, a number of pet parakeets were released by their owners.
So we know quite precisely about the first breeding attempts. It was in 69 in Cologne or so. Nowadays, there's an estimation of about having about 1,400 breeding pairs in the area.
In total, there are around 10,000 parakeets living in Germany. And some people help the birds by leaving food on their balconies.
I mean, how many birds must have escaped to be able to create a colony?
Actually, not so many. In the first time, the population growth was fairly slow. So during the first decades, there were just a couple of birds around. But then they had a huge population growth in the 19s, and nobody really knows why this happened. But the population growth was fairly slow. And then it sort of exploded since the last, I would say, 20 to 30 years.
After the museum, I go out into the open air, where the living birds belong. And I head to Brühl, a nearby town with a huge park with hundreds of trees and small lakes. It looks like a paradise, well, both for humans and the birds. In the park, I meet Dr. Michel Braun.
There's one flying to the big trees, you see, above the other trees. So they're quite far away, but they like the treetops.
Braun is an ornithologist, specialized in green parakeets. He explains the differences between the ringneck parakeets out here and the specimens I saw at the museum.
They are now in Europe, so they become larger. They get stronger beaks because their food is different from Asia. And they have longer wings because they fly distances of 20 kilometers a day. So it's like they have changed their morphology in order to survive here.
The parakeets had to go through a lot to be able to live in Europe. But how do these tropical birds manage in the cold weather of Germany?
Parakeets in Germany all share something in common. They all are restricted to cities. They are urban birds. They can only survive in the cities or in suburbia. And this is where you can find them. You can find them in Cologne, in Bonn or in Düsseldorf. But you don't find them in the mountains.
Even though they seem small and sensitive, parakeets are more resistant than I expected. But what about local birds? How do the parakeets impact them? I ask Braun if parakeets have any effects on the local birds we see around the park.
Well, here in Germany, if we go to the park and see some parakeets, it's not a negative influence on the native avifauna or on the biodiversity. So here's a different story. But it's not like it's everywhere the same. Ringneck parakeets, for example, in Australia, they are regarded as a pest species. Australia doesn't want ringneck parakeets to become established there, because there are many native parrot species in Australia. So measures in Australia are different from measures here in Europe.
As a migrant species that started living here some 50 years ago, the parakeets are still fairly new to Germany, and they continue to adapt.
As human populations are increasing in different parts of the world, there are two possibilities for the wildlife to react. They can adapt to humans, to human cities, to human agricultural land, and then they will be successful in other parts of the world as well. This is what we see in the ringneck parakeet. If they are not successful with humans, they will have a bad future.
The next day I head back to the riverside, hoping to see some parakeets again. The sun is still not out yet, and the wind is so strong that it hurts my ears. But I keep walking along the riverside and join the crowd. If the parakeets can brave this climate, so can I.
DW's Daphne Altürk with that report. Our relationship with other creatures around us isn't always a positive one. Sometimes they are a threat to us and our food sources, as is the case with the tsetse fly. The blood-sucking insects transmit parasites that cause death in humans and in livestock if left untreated. In Senegal, scientists are releasing sterile males into the environment to stop the flies from breeding. And, as Emmanuel Lande reports, they're having considerable success.
Twice a week, sterile male tsetse flies are released into the wild. Their purpose is to stop the reproduction of tsetse flies endemic to the area and eradicate them. They're reared in a laboratory in Dakar.
Here we are now in the insectarium at the National Laboratory of Veterinary Research.
Dr. Mamar Talasek has been working on controlling the population of tsetse flies at the Senegalese Agricultural Research Institute since 2006. The tsetse fly is a threat to health and agriculture across sub-Saharan Africa. They transmit trypanosomiasis, a parasitic disease that causes sleeping sickness in humans. It also makes cattle very ill, causing infertility, weight loss, and sometimes death. A nightmare for farmers who depend on their animals to survive.
This is where we receive the nymphs that have come from different insectariums. This is where we first treat them when they arrive.
Every week, Dr. Sek receives fly larvae in the nymph stage, the stage just before the tsetse fly emerges. When they get here, the nymphs have already been sterilized using nuclear radiation, a process known as sterile insect technique. The project's been jointly carried out by the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization and the International Atomic Energy Agency. They've already wiped out tsetse flies on an island in Zanzibar. These fly nymphs undergo irradiation in either Burkina Faso or Austria at the Atomic Energy Agency's Insect Pest Control Laboratory. Then they're packed into cool boxes and sent to Dakar by air freight. But only around 50% of the nymphs will turn into operational flies.
By operational, we mean they have good quality wings so they can go and do their job, which is to mate with female flies in the wild. Then their offspring will not be viable, or there simply won't be any offspring.
Flies that pass the quality test are placed in small cardboard boxes and then released, either at ground level or in the air. No wild flies have been captured since 2012, but monitoring continues. Senegalese President Macky Sall officially announced in December that wild and potentially dangerous tsetse flies have been totally wiped out over 1,000 square kilometres in the Niay Zone, a coastal farming region of Senegal. It's a huge victory for the country, as tsetse flies had been a major problem for livestock production.
We're finding symptoms of trypanosomiasis in some cattle, weight loss, anemia, a rough and unhealthy coat, and discharge in the eyes. We treated them with trypanocidal drugs, and we managed to help some recover. I have to say that we have very few cases now. Actually, I haven't seen any in a long time.
Dr. Charles Dieng is a livestock vet with 20 years' experience in the Niay region. Because farmers in Senegal usually put their cattle out to graze a certain distance away from their homes, humans haven't suffered as much as the livestock.
Here, farmers have their herd and nothing else. Your herd is your livelihood. It allows you to take care of your family. It's your life. So when you have a sick herd, it really changes a lot of things.
He witnessed firsthand the detrimental effects of tsetse flies on cattle and their farmers.
Milk production isn't great to begin with in our local cows. So when you have cases of trypanosomiasis or a general parasitic blood disease, the low output is reduced even further. That has a very negative impact on the farmer's income.
Trypanosidal injections to treat the parasitic disease spread by tsetse flies costs around 600 CFA francs or €1 per head of cattle, a cost not all low-income livestock farmers can afford.
Sometimes I came across farmers who were beside themselves because they had five or six cows and the whole family lived off the herd. But one sick animal meant there was no milk production. There was no milk and so no more revenue for the family. They would have had to sell their animals and start again from scratch. But I did on occasion treat the animals for free for some farmers to support them.
Local cows produce around 3 litres of milk per day, compared to around 30 to 40 litres by European dairy cows. 2 years ago, around 1,000 cows from France and the Netherlands were imported, and later in March this year, another 1,000 cows will arrive by boat. Through artificial insemination, some farmers have crossbred the dairy cows and seen their incomes flourish. A crossbred dairy cow can produce up to 20 litres of milk, but farmers could not have even considered crossbreeding until the tsetse fly population in the Niay region was under control, says Dr. Sek from the Agricultural Research Institute. Today, around 80% of the milk consumed in Senegal is imported, but the country's aim to boost its milk production.
More than 50 billion CFA francs are spent each year on milk imports, but the results are starting to show. Last year, the country was able to import more than 1,000 dairy cows.
Back at the insectarium in Dakar, the flies are being boxed up, ready to be airdropped from an ultralight motorised aircraft. Eric Bruno, the manager of the aerodrome in the city of Thiès, has been working closely with Dr. Sek and has even adapted one of his light aircrafts for the fly drop by adding a PVC tube to launch the fly safely below the propeller.
It's a simple pipe that launches the boxes through air pressure so that when the box slides down the tube and drops at that altitude, it bursts open and frees the flies.
Moussa Badji, a former military pilot, is in the cockpit today, accompanied by his co-pilot, who will feed the boxes into the pipe. Soon, the airdrops could be done mechanically. Eric Bruno has created a prototype launcher now being studied by the International Atomic Energy Agency.
We're working on an automatic machine with software we've created called BESI Navigator. So in the future, we'll be able to do the drop automatically. Once we're in the zone, it calculates everything and drops the flies automatically, all on its own.
The Senegalese authorities are planning to target another tsetse fly population over 5,000 square kilometres in the Sine Saloum, a mangrove area south of Dakar. The World Organization on Animal Health is yet to confirm that livestock in the Niay region are in the clear and that the disease transmitted by the tsetse fly has well and truly been eliminated, even if the flies are no longer there. For DW, Emmanuel Landet in Dakar.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of Living Planet. Many thanks to Ileana Galladucci and Christoph Grover for their help making this show happen. And to you for listening. I have been, and still am, Jordan Wilden. Until next time.